You're in for an awesome episode this week. Dr. Stuart Flynn is the founding dean of Fort Worth's new MD school, established by UNT Health Science Center and TCU. We focus on the future of healthcare on this episode. Go ahead and subscribe now, then share with a friend. Thanks. Dr. Flynn, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
So I'm going to set the stage here a little bit. This episode is going to be a lot about the future of healthcare. Dr. Flynn's going to tell us what's coming. So let's jump right on in.
No pressure.
Yeah, for sure. So I like the way you described it when we met a couple weeks ago. You're essentially at the beginning of the assembly line. What does the future doctor look like from your perspective?
Well, I think, a lot of things are changing. So it's our job to try to predict where things are going and then train the next generation, start their training appropriately in that regard. So I think there are many kind of major endeavors happening. One is there'll be a very concerted effort to keep people healthy, rather than be physicians, be great diagnosticians, and then treating. So that's going to be their first task, is keep us healthy, appropriate weight, quit smoking, exercise, which we have not done a great job in the past for a host of reasons, not that we don't think they're appropriate. Because of that, a lot of healthcare will be delivered outside of hospital systems. So the next thing we have to train the next generation, how to work outside of a hospital instead of have all their training be inside of a hospital, which is what has been very traditional. Technology will continue to grow and become a major asset and a major ally for how we deliver medicine and how we engage with our patients. So we have to familiarize the next generation with that, make them comfortable with it. I can't predict what technology is going to look like 10 years from now, but they should not be intimidated by it. They should embrace it. The patients are embracing it, therefore we should embrace it as physicians.
Yeah, I mean, you hit on a lot of different things there. What does care look like outside of hospital? Is that just in more of a retail setting? Is that telehealth? Is that, I guess, at home care? I'm sure it's a little bit of all of the above, but how do you, I guess, train for those different avenues there? I mean, those are all very different.
Yeah, it's the overused euphemism of we're trying to go to where the puck is going rather than where it is. So I think if one were to put this conversation into a time capsule and open it up 10 years from now, I'd be happy if we hit the 50th percentile. So I think you hit on some of them. I think 10, 15 years from now, number one, you will get a lot of your healthcare not walking into a physician's office. So that'll be a radical change. We've all gotten used to that. And then that starts to beg the question of the personal interaction, which is legitimate. I do think that we will be receiving healthcare, to your point, in retail settings, notably in rural America. That's what exists in rural America, not physicians' offices, but Walmarts. And that's not lost on the Walmarts and the Amazons of the world. So they're definitely they're diving in almost head first to change the paradigm. You mentioned telemedicine, telehealth. Absolutely. You ought to be able, and we can do this now, communicate at 2 a.m. with your little baby with an ability for me to look at the baby's ear to see if there's an ear infection or not. You shouldn't have to drive to an ER to have that diagnosed. That's a huge endeavor. And then the last comment you made, which I think is spot on, is the issue of kind of home health. And again, the less we think of medicine as being one-on-one personal, as much as that's critical, we become much more efficient when we can do things that I don't need to be looking you in the eye to do, such as order tests, get imaging studies. So when I actually do meet with you, and maybe that will be virtually, maybe it won't be, and I'm not advocating for that, but I think there's a pragmatism to how we optimize and make medicine more efficient. Then when I actually do meet with you, I have a much more complete picture of who you are rather than meeting with you and then sending you out for your tests and your imaging studies. So as I said, 10 years from now, if even half of what I said is accurate, I'll be pleased. It's a rapidly evolving world.
Yeah, I mean, you hit on it a little bit there around the efficiency and who is essentially quarterbacking that care. Do you still think in 10 years that primary care physicians will be the ones predominantly meeting with patients, and then you'll have doctors doing different things around that? Or what do you think that looks like?
Right. So where I grew up, which was in northern Michigan, there were only primary care physicians. Mm-hmm. They delivered the babies. They looked in the ears of kids. They did the sports physicals. You can go down the list. So I think a couple things that, and one of which is already very much evolving, is now medicine is not only delivered as by a team, we're actually respecting and appreciating the team rather than the physician being the king or queen of the mountain talking down to his or her masses. So that's the first thing. And you as a patient, you just want appropriate, expeditious care. You don't necessarily need a single person that has to be the one who delivers it to you. So that's the first kind of major evolution, I think, is optimizing how you engage with the healthcare system. If it's always with a physician, then we already know we're against a wall because we don't have the numbers to really see you for non-emergent things. And then to your point about primary care physicians, I think as we now appreciate that they are the gatekeeper to trying to keep the cost of medicine down, mm-hmm. because if you go to see a specialist in field X, that specialist has a certain set of tools. Those tools often get used because that's what we do if we're a plumber or a carpenter. Those tools are expensive. They're great tools when they should be used. They run up the cost of healthcare when they're just used kind of, I wouldn't say whimsically, that will insult my colleagues, but maybe the gate isn't quite as tightly kept. So, and how are we going to empower the primary care physicians? We're going to have to reimburse them for their really critical role in healthcare. And that just hasn't been the way it has played out. We have paid them the least. We've compensated them the least, so it becomes a volume market. So how do you make more money? You see more patients. And when you see more patients, we know where this goes. And it's kind of where healthcare is right now. People are frustrated.
Yeah. You hit on it a little bit there, but why would you say like healthcare innovation is lacking from like an efficiency standpoint, just across the board? I think it'd be interesting to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, I think one of the root causes of healthcare innovation somewhat having been limited is one of the issues is individuals in academic healthcare centers were not business people. They were people who wanted to make discoveries. But the discoveries didn't necessarily align perfectly with the market. So we love what we do. We made this great discovery. And yet then pharma or biotech says, well, that was great, but there's no market for it. But when you work with the other facets of healthcare industry, and now they have a question, they need a medication for X, can you help us with that? Now you're starting to align better. So that's one of the things that our school is very much trying to do. We're trying to work with industry. The asset in Fort Worth is a very large, very good healthcare system with a lot of patients. Mm-hmm. What does biotech need? What does pharma need to do their trials on drugs and devices? They need large cohorts of patients. That's how they do their trials to see if their drug works or doesn't work. So that's been a rate limiting step basically forever. And it becomes an issue of intellectual property, who owns it, licensing, patents. So if I discover something amazing, well, I'd like to patent it, keep it, license it, and win a Nobel Prize. But Roche Pharmaceuticals would love to work with me because they're the ones who are going to manufacture that drug. And so you can see where there's been not adversarial, just a natural disconnect. We both were chasing amazing things in health and healthcare. We just didn't connect ourselves with one another very typically.
Yeah, some of that research happening here on the pharmaceutical side, I've not had really any conversations or insight into that realm. So I would love to hear, like, and DFW is huge, but like at UNT and TCU, like, is some of that research happening here?
So I think if you look at historically where discoveries are made in medicine, they're made within a 25-mile radius of academic medical centers.
Okay.
Fort Worth really has not had that. Do they have all the ingredients? They have all the ingredients.
Okay.
We have people. We have great healthcare systems. Beautiful place to live. I can go down the list.
Yeah.
There's not an adverse element to it. We believe the medical school now should be the nidus to now start to attract nationally and internationally more. There's some, but more. Dallas does a very nice job with this. Fort Worth has all the same ingredients. We should do the same. So we actually have started working. We work with Illumina, which is the national platform for genomics. We work with GE. We're starting to work with IBM and Watson. Now, are we Johns Hopkins? We're not.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, part of this that I really am embracing, because it's been something I've watched my whole career, but I finally get a chance to operationalize it, is what I said earlier, and that is take our assets in this community, including a large population, and align it with industry rather than sequestering it from industry and then doing our thing. And we would make some great discoveries. And then the question would be, would industry care to translate them? Because at the end of the day, they're doing this to make money. And we don't fault them for that at all. I'd like to be their partner rather than just working independent of their ambitions. We have something powerful to offer them. They have something powerful to offer us.
You briefly hit on it there with what you guys are doing with genomics and IBM Watson. Can you give us some insight there?
Sure. So you know, one thing we can't lose sight of training the next generation of physicians is they have to have foundational knowledge, medical mm-hmm. knowledge. So that's not unique to any medical school. It better be in every medical school.
So.
Yeah, you would like your physician to know the Krebs cycle and how blood coagulates and all of those gory kinds of things. But the other part of it that we have the wonderful opportunity here, because we came here with a clean slate. That was really the attraction to come here. So we could train more outside of the hospital setting, because we know that's where healthcare is going. We could train in the issue of empathy and communication, because we know we haven't done a good job training. So then you ask about genomics and artificial intelligence and the like. We absolutely know, you don't have to be a guru to know that when our first graduating class starts practicing by themselves, what will be cascading over them will in fact be the role of their patient's genome, their genetics, their mutations. And then hopefully not only to know what the mutations are, how do we start intervening? We don't know where to intervene if we don't know what the mutations are. Artificial intelligence it already is overlaying in a lot we do in medicine, but we're just at the most nascent point. Machine mm-hmm. learning, how we data mine into patient records and pull something out for you very personally and say, whoa, we wouldn't have seen that if we were just going through your charts. But data mining has picked something out that now we can intervene with you. So from a genomics perspective, as you probably know well, we sequenced the entire human genome at the turn of this century. So it's been a while now. People had predicted that by now all of our genomes would be sequenced and sitting in our electronic medical records. That has not become true. Can we do it? We can do it. And you can do an entire sequence for under $1,000. So
okay.
It's not like it's $1 million a patient. That is where this is going. So we are now working with Illumina. We're working with one of their big spin-off data mining spin-offs for electronic health records. So how do we prepare our students for that? They should not go out cold when they're all done with all of their training, which is a minimum of 7 years. And the first day they hear this word genomics and say, where did that come from?
Yeah, what is that?
Right. And so what we've done is built this curriculum that transcends their beginning of their training, but will actually permeate all 4 years. So their genomics first real deep dive in just ended 3 weeks ago. So one way to make any topic kind of stick is make it personal. So rather than sequencing all of our students, which we could do, but then there will be all kinds of issues that we really don't need to do. They can all go get sequenced if they want. We sequence their cadavers that patients have donated their bodies to be studied for anatomy. But you can do, so we could sequence that was all done through the appropriate protocols. And what they saw, this is really a medical student's first patient. And what they saw then on a patient that they're working on to learn anatomy is now they realized at the subcellular molecular level, this patient has the following genes, genetics, including mutations. So at the end of this, that was they got exposed to a patient who looking at her, totally healthy looking, but has a mutation that folks struggled to diagnose when she was young. Whereas if you had her sequence in her EMR, you would have known what she had right from the get-go. We had another advocate for a rare disease who has two children with the disease. Again, these are genetic diagnoses, support of something you see going wrong. And in her case, the earlier you intervene on these children, the less harm they have for their lifetime. So you can imagine as a 24, 26, 28-year-old physician in training and have a mom talk in front of you about two of her children with this same disease, one of whom was diagnosed later, mm-hmm. and can only communicate through movement of his eyes. Oh, wow. The next child diagnosed earlier has a walker, is on the cheer squad for her school. You know, those stick with you. Those are stories remember them when they're 80 years old. So that's how we're taking genomics fully. I will now predict what someone predicted in 2006, and it was wrong, that everyone would have their sequence in their electronic health records by 2019 was the year the individual predicted. I will predict that by 2030, when they're really out in practice, we will all have our sequence in the EMR. So I'll say it again, they need to be comfortable with that and embrace it. They don't have to be experts in it at mm-hmm. all. We have the experts that surround us and can help us. What they can't do is they can't be intimidated by it.
Yeah. Is that the genomic testing that you just referenced, is that different than 23andMe? I mean, that's DNA testing. That's very affordable. Like
right.
What you're talking about seems much more in depth. Like, where do you even go to get that done?
Yeah, you can get it right done here in North Texas. You can get it done.
Do you go to like a Quest?
No, Quest. I don't know if Quest does it. I would not be surprised if they do. Yeah. UT Arlington is the epicenter for the North Texas Genomics Institute. They're the ones who sequenced our cadavers. But the difference is what we get in a whole genome sequence is everything.
Okay.
What 23andMe does, very strategic, is they look at
like 100 things.
Yeah, they look at things that are important. I mean, they're all important. Some of them, you know, like your risk for breast cancer is a good one. My issue with that is that's a direct to consumer. So you get these results back. So you may get your results back, and it says, the report states you have a 4 times increased incidence of Alzheimer's.
Yeah, what do
and
you
you're,
do?
And
with
you're
that?
22 years old, yeah. right? So on one hand, you say, "I'll worry about that when I get older."
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you do get older, and it's kind of gnarling in the back. So what are the issues? The issues are you don't have any support around that. You don't know what that means. So now you have to go out and try to find it.
Yeah.
And where do you go? You go to your primary care physician, who very, very highly probable really can't be your expert in that. Not because they're stupid. It's not what they're not trained in that, right? So that's the first thing. It's direct to consumer. The second thing is it's proprietary. So you're not quite sure what the heck they actually tested. So I'll give you an example. So for instance, now there are two major mutations for the risk of breast cancer. There are more than two, but there are two that are very focused on breast cancer. Well, when you get your risk back, let's say you have no increased risk. Okay, that's great news. Now the question is, Did they test for both of those? Well, you don't know because it's proprietary, you know, and I'm not saying they're disingenuous. They're trying to lead and be on the cutting edge. So 23andMe is a small focus subset of what your entire genome looks like.
Gotcha.
So
you talked about it very early on, but I guess getting away from episodic care and I guess making sure people are healthier overall, like, I mean, how are you guys going about doing that from, I guess, a doctor's perspective? Like, it's very difficult to get people to change behavior if it's a diet issue or a fitness or they smoke 2 packs a day. Right. Like, how, I guess, is that changing?
Right. So I would love to give you the illusion that physicians and the healthcare team are so omnipotent that we could do that. Just give me 2 more minutes with every patient. So this will be a societal endeavor, and that's just the way it is, right? We have to have school systems that when it comes to healthy eating, I mean, where do young people until they're 18 spend the bulk of their waking hours? It's in a school. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, in the olden days, I'm being facetious, maybe we would have had cigarette vending machines. Well, those would have gone.
Yeah.
But we still have vending machines with
We've
stuff
got
that.
Vape ones.
Well, hopefully not much longer, at least from my point of view. But, you know, you have a vending machine that has foods that are fun to eat. We get it. But when you have an epidemic of obesity in our young population and now type 2 diabetics in the youth, that was unheard of when I was early in my, just absolutely unheard of. It is a societal endeavor. We have to believe it's important. And if you struggle to believe why it's important, if you look at the GDP for healthcare, a lot of it is being spent on issues that have an element of prevention to them. Screening for cancers, obesity. The fact that 25% of all individuals in the U.S. have done no exercise in the last month. You know, these are things. So then how do we collectively start to empower that? Well, from a physician's and a health team perspective, you and I have to have a relationship. If I just tell you at the end of our visit, that's your annual physical, by the way, you need to quit smoking. That's just not.
You're gonna
not
say gonna, okay, and
yeah, right. You're gonna say I'll see you in a year, doc.
On the way home.
Exactly. So I and you know if these strategies were easy, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But I think, given the cost of healthcare, the way we can start to lower it in things that we actually can empower, I think I'm watching an impetus to make this change. Now, some of the proposals are quite problematic for the individual. So if you're, I won't pick smoking, I'll pick obese. If you're obese, we know you're going to encounter the healthcare system more frequently. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you're going to be a greater cost to yourself and to the system. So do we now charge a different healthcare premium for you? On the more positive side, so that's an incentive, right? It's a negative incentive. So the FDA just came out last week with now an approved pill that you can take to suppress appetite. So now you say to yourself, you know, it's easy if you're not overweight to look at somebody overweight and say, well, why don't they just quit eating so much, right? Or why mm-hmm. don't they exercise? Or smokers, why don't you just quit smoking? Well, we all know it's not that simple, even though we're not necessarily overweight or we're not smokers. But now if you can put something else in that is a support to that patient, that's another part of this equation when it comes to obesity, for instance. So we are at the beginning of, we've known this, we've watched it. When I was a young person, it was smoking cessation. There weren't nicotine patches, there weren't gums, mm-hmm. but we really weren't taught, okay, smoking was much more prevalent then.
Yeah.
How do I talk with you as a 24-year-old? How do I talk with you as a 54-year-old to quit smoking? We knew you should quit smoking, we weren't given the tools. And I think it starts with the relationship between the physician and his or her patient. That's the beginning, and that's the part we're working really hard on.
Very good. You seem much more optimistic about the future than definitely some people in healthcare. I guess from a doctor's perspective, where are they getting this ongoing training? Say they go work at a Baylor or a THR. Mm-hmm. Like, what does that look like? I've seen just on social media, mm-hmm. I guess JPS posts some of their training. Like, mm-hmm. are they continually training on these different things? Or do you have any insight into what that looks like from once somebody's mid-career,
right,
and how they go about doing some of these things?
It's a great question, as opposed to at some point deciding to coast to retirement, mm-hmm. which is hard to coast in as a physician, but if that's your, and I don't think anyone does that, quite frankly, so I'm being a little facetious. So I think we have had the opportunity here. I'll start with medical student education. We've had the opportunity here that we didn't have to inherit from anybody else. That's mm-hmm. that's hard, because medical school education is rooted in 1910. So all the schools, when you look at them, and then you go back and look at the Flexner report, you say, wow, a lot of similarities to how Flexner defined how 2 years of preclinical, 2 years ago. Okay.
Yeah.
So we get to break that mold where it's appropriate. There are a lot of things we keep because those are also appropriate.
Still have to have the foundation.
Exactly. Then our young people, and they will be nationally competitive for high-end, excellent residency training programs. There's your next iteration of training. Well, residency training hasn't changed for a whole bunch of reasons. But here in Tarrant County, with our partners, we are starting to expand, and you'll see some very nice announcements coming out, residency training. So it's kind of the same thing. Clean slate again. So then you mentioned the mid-career physician. Where does this happen? I will just give you one anecdote. So we have this very strong communication team that we unabashedly stole from Alan Alda in New York City. Everyone realizes the value of this. Most of us weren't trained to know how to communicate with you in the tricks of the trade. We're physicians. We talk with you. We tell you to get prescriptions filled, and we'll see you in your
5 to 10 minutes.
Yeah, right. So the beauty has been nationally with our team, but definitely in Tarrant County and in Dallas County and elsewhere. I want to be real fair-spirited about this. There's an insatiability to looking at physician groups. They're looking to get better. This is one of the areas. So we have to be pretty strong governors on where this team and who they can engage with. And I'll give you a very tangible. So those, you mentioned JPS, absolutely. Baylor All Saints, absolutely. THR, they want this training for their practicing physicians. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, it's about their patients. It's not about their physicians.
Yeah.
But we just signed an affiliation with the American Heart Association for communications. Then you say, well, what the heck is that all about? Any scientist who is funded now, starting now with the American Heart Association, that's obviously the leading cause of death in this country. Therefore, the science and discovery around that is critical. Mm-hmm. With our affiliation with them now, if you get grant funding from them, you have to take a sequence of video modules that teach you that help you. I won't say teach you. It's not like we don't communicate at all. Help you communicate with patients, but then critically with support groups, with the lay population, and with the press. So it's no longer good enough just to be a great scientist and make great discoveries. Now you need to share those. Everyone needs to have some appreciation and then get excited about what's happening. This is a big deal for the American Heart Association.
And because you guys they don't have to do this. Supporting them through the modules.
We are the communicator. Yeah. And so that's national, but very much local. We have more requests. It's Yvonne Kaplan-Liss and her team. We have more requests than we can personally go out and do. But we're putting together these modules. So now your point, mid-career physician, I won't make it punitive. Something bad has happened. You have to watch the modules. Just every year, annual compliance, engage with these two or three modules. And you do get better. Mm-hmm. You just do. There's no, you can, don't like the fact that I have to spend 37 minutes to do three modules. At the end of the day, kicking and screaming, we do get better when we do these things.
Yeah. I mean, you're hitting on it there around empathy and communication. Why has that been lacking, I guess? Or it sounds like you guys are doing a ton of things to improve in that avenue. What does that, I guess, look like and mean to TCU and UNT?
Yeah, and I want to be clear that every physician, or virtually every physician, when he or she goes to medical school, they truly are above their peer group when it comes to empathy. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't start this way.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there are a host of reasons, and you know, some we've hit on. It's time. It's hospitalization, and you have to have your patient in and out in 24 hours. So you really don't get to know your patient. So I don't want to offend my physician colleagues. Mm-hmm. I'm one of them, but it's never been a focus. But back in the day, where physicians did house calls, where you weren't on an assembly line and had a 7 minute, 27 second period per patient. I'm being a little snarky about that. And that's a reimbursement issue, right?
It's the system set them up to
So
fail.
back when I was probably a teenager, if I went to a physician, that individual had the time, didn't have to rush through it. Wasn't because the individual was trained to do that. It was just there was no need.
That's how they get reimbursed, and it's moved to the volume.
It is moved to a cost for procedure, a cost for volume. So we by ourselves as a little medical school can't undo those pressures. Mm-hmm. Those exist.
Yeah.
But there are ways to undo some of these pressures on the non-physician side of things. But obviously, bureaucracy is something that is its own beast that you can talk about and complain about. But to change it, because that's government-driven, it's third-party payer-driven, and so on. But there's the other part of it is if your physician really knows you, so when you come back in 6 months from now for whatever reason, the physician knows that you do podcasts, that you work in downtown Fort Worth, that you're married, not married, you have two children, one now is in kindergarten. Those are all things that make a relationship between you and me. Yeah. If you just become, Matt, okay, why am I seeing you? Oh, you need your thyroid medications, you need to be, have some blood drawn. There's where the empathy goes. So we all start there. That's the good news. Now we need to figure out how to sustain it. And we've built our curriculum, which has been nicely tried in other countries, notably in Canada and Australia, where lo and behold, a medical student starts and 4 years later graduates pretty much on the same curve of empathy that the individual started. Now our trick is, that's us. We're one medical school.
Yeah.
Others can steal anything they want from us. None of it's proprietary. We share a lot nationwide. Now the next is when they're residents. It's the same issue. So I go back to saying in Tarrant County, we're starting brand new residency programs. We can keep the good, but we can build some other things that other residents. I can go, if I go to an established school and try to change, I ran Yale's residency programs. If I try to change something there, I'm an N of one against the masses, and people don't like change. But in Tarrant County, guess what? We're really not changing anything. We're building new. So, and it's got to start someplace. Mm-hmm. If politics are local, then I would submit medical education is local. We do a great job. My alma mater in Ann Arbor will be asking me, how in the heck did you do this? Well, how can we? And that'll be the ultimate compliment. And we don't do it for that reason, but that'll be nice to share it with our colleagues.
Yeah. Very nice. You talked a little bit about it, but utilizing big data from EMR systems and things like that, are those things that like the doctor does, or are there like typically teams within a health system that does that, and then they come back with the results to the doctor? I've never been clear.
Well, it's a great question, and I apologize for cutting you off. I get excited about. The disclaimer: I'm not an artificial intelligence guru at all, right?
So neither am I.
Right, so we're in good shape. We can say some really stupid stuff, and then your listeners can beat us up, and that's okay. The data, your healthcare data exists. So let's start from what we know. It exists. It's sitting in an EMR. And there are a whole bunch of issues with that. How do we share among the pharmacy and your, you know, okay, that those are other issues. Those are big issues that we need to get much better at. But it sits there. So there are algorithms behind the scenes now that are already written that, so you ask, so we're working right now where we've asked questions of de-identified data. I don't want to know it's you. I'm looking at a population health basis. All 30-year-olds who don't smoke and have hypercalcemia. Show me who they are. How many? Okay, there actually will be a couple. Now, did that get picked up? The answer is whoever ordered that test saw that. That one's not going to fly under the radar, but there'll be something else, or more importantly, a matrix of findings that when you put the whole matrix down, you say, yikes, I think we need to look into X, Y, or Z. So it's not necessarily a single variable. There are algorithms that once you ask that question, they can be written by the computer scientist to ask the question. And now you get back results. So we now, with permission, could identify you. And now you'd get a phone call. Hey, we'd like you to come in and have, you know, pick some imaging study done. We're just concerned. If you wait for the healthcare team to see that, you can imagine how that may not happen. In hindsight, we'll go, how did we not see this? Yeah. But if you know, if you look at IBM Watson, I think the number is it can read 25 billion books in a second.
That's pretty quick.
Right. That's a tad quick. So if we can harness that to your advantage. So I think genomic sequencing is one such example. When that sits in your EMR, and all of a sudden, you know, you start having this we can't figure out why you're fatigued and everything that we would look at, whether are you anemic or not, and your diet, and it's all fine. Maybe sitting in your genomics is a mitochondrial mutation that I maybe wouldn't have been smart enough to go look at, but I hit that button and I'm being a little simplistic and it comes back. You know, your patient has this mutation and 12% of those patients have an issue with chronic fatigue. I would have never seen that.
Yeah, and that's starting to happen now.
That is happening now. Okay, and I would say it's at the very, very nascent stage. So the company we're working with, because we don't, they're a genomics data mining organization. Mm-hmm. They're just these, you know, they're Cal Berkeley. I love them to death. So in case they hear this, I don't want them to think I'm being a smart aleck. They want to go in and mine genomic data for partners, but right now that doesn't really exist. So they're mining with us, kind of conventional laboratory and diagnostic parameters, because they're cutting their teeth. So when everyone has his or her genome in an EMR, they're going to be ready to rock and roll.
Yeah.
They're not the only ones doing it. This is something that when we harness this better and better and better, we are going to be much better. And by the way, I may have more time to spend with you because I'm already getting guidance as to maybe what your underlying problem is, instead of spending all my time trying to figure out exactly what your underlying problem is.
I like it. It sounds like the future is bright. I'm curious, from your perspective, how can we as consumers of healthcare get a little bit better at consuming from a primary care? Mm-hmm. Is it going to the actual primary care? I mean, during open enrollment meetings, I asked that question and made 25 to 30% typically raise their hand that they have a primary care. Any advice for the listener of how to be a better, healthier consumer?
Yeah, I think so that is one of them. You have to have confidence. If you're going to go to a primary care physician, then you have to have confidence that that person's your partner, right? But in some states, not in all, and I believe Texas is one of them, if you think you're having some kind of weird heartbeat, well, you can bypass your primary care doc. And you and I both might say, well, yeah, the primary care doc would have done the initial exam and may have found the problem.
Yeah.
But even then may have sent you to a cardiologist. So, you know, you just kind of circumvented that.
Yeah.
Okay. Sometimes get it. Sometimes maybe not. I think another part that we're very keen on educating our students about is patients now are amazing consumers of healthcare through the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the information is spot on. Some of it's very shady. So for you, you're on the internet. You have a cough. You want to figure out what's going on. Do I need an antibiotic? Is it lung cancer and I'm 24 years old? Probably not. So let's eliminate. But you know what? Other than your age, the cough sounds like it could be. Your physician and your healthcare team, I want to keep saying that. It's not just, they need to be an advocate and a supporter of you rather than being dismissive and being offended that you're out looking for answers for yourself. I think you will find that you will appreciate that team approach. You get to do some of the work. Your team gets to validate or challenge some of your work. So that's another big issue in this, because you're gonna search it on the internet. The moms do it all day and all night for their kids. Just don't be offended by that.
Yeah.
And I think you'll have a different relationship with your pediatrician or your primary care, your cardiologist, your orthopedic surgeon. So it's not a direct answer to your question. I think there are some things that we can make really, really nice strides in the relationships and therefore the confidence that you have in the healthcare system and we have in you as a patient, that you're a partner with us. You're not fighting us all the way.
I like it. There's a lot of good points there. We can wrap up here with a few easy rapid-fire questions. I'd be interested to hear what your favorite interview question is for students. I don't know if you interview any of them coming in, but...
Well, we've changed the interview style, but I did admissions at Yale for 18 years.
Okay.
My favorite question, and only because it didn't give me an answer that I would use in making a decision, but I knew, having been in their shoes, how absolutely nervous and even terrified they were walking into my office. So my first question always was, tell me about your university, because you can answer that, right? And so they would say,
very disarming.
Exactly. I go to the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and you know, it's really a cool university. I could do without the snow in the winter.
Yeah.
Now, when you go to your second question, they just have calmed nicely down. So it wasn't really a question for information back.
Yeah.
It was a question to set up the next 30 or 40 minutes with them. So now they were relaxed a little bit.
That was very kind.
Yeah, and I learned a ton about different universities around the country, which was also pretty. So if you ask me how Harvard is with their undergrads, I wouldn't tell you on air. Good or bad, love you, Brian. But I can tell you about a lot of universities and how their students feel their university engages with them.
I've asked this question in other ways, but I heard somebody else ask it much better. What essentially gives you your edge? Is it consuming a ton of information? Are you reading a ton of different things? Are you blocking it all out? I feel like people fall into one of a few categories, so I'd be interested.
Yeah, so explain what you mean by giving my edge. It's like my assistant's been talking, he's always on edge. So tell me what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, you're the dean of a medical school, so obviously have been successful and have a demanding schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And you do a lot of different things like this. Are you consuming a ton of information? Are you blocking all the news out? How, I guess, you stay focused, given that you're being pulled a ton of different directions?
Yeah, well, I'll start with, and it sounds trite or even corny to use a Midwest term, but you know, I'm grounded by my family, so that makes life very nice, right? Then, and because of them, they allow me to spend time on other things. If I use the word edge as to something positive, so I've been given, I've coached my whole life, and I've said that I just think soccer is the most amazing game in the world. Okay, but I would then, and the reason I say that is I think I have just an unbelievably great job doing what I do, and it's doubled by being at a brand new medical school where people are allowing us to really push the envelope.
Yeah.
So one thing I really hark on, having now done this for a lot of years, is you learn what not to do. So I've learned a lot of what not to do, and yet it's very easy to gravitate there. So that in part is my edge. That's not reading a lot. It's like, don't do this. That doesn't work. Right. Yeah. And yet everyone still does it. Why? Well, that's how they did it for me, kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then what I really enjoy on behalf of then educating the next generation is trying to predict where 2030 and 2040 are going to be. Not because I'm so smart I can do that, but I would love these young people when it's 2030 and they've been out in practice for 3 years saying, you know, I didn't get it at the time, but wow, I actually feel I can go with the shifting sands and they don't make me fall over. You know, it's the classic of what you tell your children. Oh, you wait until you grow up. You'll see what we're talking about. Actually, most of us grow up and realize, doggone it, mom and dad were right.
They were right.
So that's what really, I'm a molecular pathologist by training. And so that's really what drives me. And I do think a lot of this is the future. We've talked about it. We've talked about technology and the like. What doesn't work in medical school? Having young people sit in lectures for 50 minutes. So then why would I design a curriculum where they sit in lecture halls for 50 minutes? And everyone across internationally, they complain, oh, medical students don't come to lectures. Well, why don't they come to lectures? Well, can we say podcasts? So they podcast and they don't need to sit and listen to me. They can listen to me tonight at 8 o'clock, right? While they're eating a bowl of popcorn and they're in their pajamas. So we set this school up. We're not doing that. So it's those kinds of things
This is,
I'm transitioning out of my career, which went from, you know, strong clinical care, diagnostic and science to now major education. It's been that way for 13 years. That's the mark I want to leave, but I'm leaving it for generations of docs who are going to care for you and care for your family.
We appreciate it, and thank you for coming on.
Well, this is fantastic. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks again. Thanks for giving the show a listen. Please do me a favor before you stop listening. Subscribe on whatever platform you're on. If you loved it so much and you've already subscribed, share this episode with a friend. Thanks again, and I'll see you next week.
Matt McGee is an employee of Frost Insurance. All opinions shared by Matt or guests of the Healthy Conversations podcast are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Frost Insurance or Frost Bank. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for insurance, banking, or investment advice. Healthy Conversations with Matt McGee is brought to you by Straight Up Podcasts.